Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Hope you enjoyed Friday's episode where Sagar and I had a big, semi-contentious debate around Ukraine, NATO, Sweden, Finland, all those topics. Those episodes are going to happen much more often, basically for now, every 2 weeks, with plans to expand into weekly. This is a part of our expanded coverage coming out of the Ukraine crisis and with our support from our Supercast subscribers that are available for everyone there, especially those who can't afford the support and see that there. So once again, if you have not gotten the chance yet, I'd really appreciate it if you go into the top of your show notes. And if you can't afford to pay for a realignment subscription to support our expansion, you go do that as well there too. Once again, there's a link at the top of the show notes. We've brought in tens of thousands of dollars so far, and this is going to do so much work to help us expand our coverage, expand the show, and help remunerate the staff who are working hard for this. Like, the entire goal this year is not for Sagar or myself to use any of that to pay ourselves any salary. It's all just to expanding and making this the best podcast we can. On to today's episode, I'm speaking with Yasha Munk. He is the author of The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart, How They Can Endure. So the diversity part isn't just a comment about race and ethnicity, which is obviously really contentious, especially in the West. This is also about culture, and it's also about politics and identity. We've had this question so many different ways, so it's really interesting to have this conversation with Yasha. Yasha has a great background to discuss this issue. He is a German, Polish, Jewish migrant to the United States. So he has and is no stranger to individual parts of your identity being in conflict as you're trying to actually exist in a country. So many great things here. I know you enjoy this episode. Once again, just want to stress the importance of our Supercast drive this month. We really want to see and get some legs under this so that we can keep going and grow bigger and bigger and better than ever. Huge thank you to Lincoln Network for also providing support for the show. Hope you enjoy the episode. Yasha Munk, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks so much for having me, Marshall.
I've encountered more and more authors whose books are timed perfectly with the news cycle. In the case of Twitter, it's a little better. The Ukraine part, that's not great. Obviously, a world where the Ukraine war is happening is a better one. But let's just start with the newsier bits here to really draw the audience in. So Elon Musk is in the process of attempting to acquire Twitter. We're recording this on Friday morning. This is coming out on Tuesday, the release of day of your book. So insert the statement that everything could change. But as it stands Friday morning, Elon is effectively arguing that he thinks his vision of an open, uncensored, unfettered Twitter is key to a functioning democratic society. Let's just take him in good faith and assume that's what he's believing. What do you think of that argument?
So let's back up for a second. I think what we have at the moment is just a really weird situation where one of the key avenues of public debate is owned by a private company. And they are making decisions to censor people, which are arbitrary. This is not a question of bad faith. I think the people who are trying to make those decisions, by and large, think of themselves, as most people do, as being well-intentioned. And they're probably even trying to be somewhat consistent. But first of all, they're just going to make lots of mistakes. Because it's just really hard to read the context of a tweet when you're not deep in a debate. Secondly, they're going to have their own strong political biases. And third, even if this actually was evenly applied, people would always get the impression that the other side is being favored. Because when somebody on the other side is being censored, you think, well, they probably have it coming to them. I don't know that much about them, but they seem really bad. Whereas when somebody on your own side is being censored, you think, come on, what on earth is going on here, right? So the mistakes are going to weigh a lot more. And so as a result, we have a situation at the moment where there's really capricious decisions being made about what can be said and what can't be said. And everybody gets more and more angry. Everybody feels like I'm under siege, you know, I'm being shut up and the other side gets to talk. That is just really, really, really unhealthy. So, you know, before we get into is it going to improve and what it's going to look like, we just have to say what we have right now really is not working. So my favorite standard is that private companies, which obviously are allowed to do what they want, Twitter clearly has a legal right to censor whoever they want, has a legal right to censor people just because they criticize, you know, Twitter, has a legal right to do what they want. But I wish that they would adapt First Amendment standards for themselves. But they say everything that's covered by the First Amendment, we are going to allow on our platform. That's going to include lots of nasty stuff, lots of stuff that I'll deeply dislike. But it won't include child pornography. It won't include direct incitements to hatred. It won't include certain forms of defamation. And that, I think, would be the right kind of standard. Now, whether or not Elon Musk actually will bring Twitter closer to that, your guess is as good as mine. I have no idea.
And do you think that First Amendment standard would make a diverse, contentious society such as the United States a healthier one?
You know, I do think so, because there's actually no real way of shutting up the voices we don't like, right? Like, look, some people defend free speech on the grounds that, you know, every contribution is valuable and, you know, everything is wonderful. No, there's lots of stuff in society, but it's really stupid and nasty, right? I'm a deep believer in the efficacy of the vaccines and what an amazing contribution that was. I would really rather live in a society where nobody's choosing to share, you know, conspiracy theories about the vaccines. But there was recently a study, you know, touted by Stanford University, by some researchers there, but touted by their official Twitter account, saying the cost of free speech is hundreds of thousands of people more have died in the United States because of misinformation about vaccines. And that just fundamentally gets wrong how a free society operates, because they're sort of imagining, you know, what if we had a free society in which we have the trust that comes with knowing that vaccines can be criticized, in which we have freedoms we enjoy, but somehow miraculously nobody is sharing bullshit. That would be a great world, but that just isn't a realistic world. What's the real alternative? We can see that in China, right? In China, you can't criticize vaccines on social media freely. You can't criticize the government freely. And by various estimates, we don't have the exact numbers, up to 50% of elderly people did not get vaccinated. Why? Because nobody trusts a system where you know you can't criticize it, right? So free speech has lots of costs, lots of bad things, lots of nasty things, right? But the cost of trying to suppress that is actually higher than the cost of living with that, of pushing back against it, of saying, this is nasty, we disapprove of that, but they can say what they want.
So the other newsy question that will lead us into discussing the actual book is almost meta question about how the war in Ukraine has influenced the frame by what you think about this book. So this book is The Great Experiment. It's about this idea of diverse democracies, such as the United States, many Western countries, whether or not they could fall apart. And coming into the conflict, a key reality here was, and Putin explicitly stated this, this is very clear in Russian thinking, Western democratic societies are weak, they're brittle, they're not going to be able to stand up to authoritarian power. This is a broader narrative. How has, once again, we don't know what's going to come out of this, but how have you just been thinking about this as an author who was writing a book before the war started and is now coming out 2 months into the conflict?
Yeah, look, so that's two thoughts I've had about the way in which this terrible attack on Ukraine illustrates the themes of a book, right? So the first is that, as you're saying, Putin fought the West as decadent, fought that precisely because of our diversity, precisely because we're so cacophonous, precisely because we have people from all over the world, precisely because we don't have one shared ethnicity, Western nations are not going to be willing to stand up to his will. And that's one of the reasons why he assumed that his troops would definitely be in Kyiv by now. He assumed that his troops would have been in Kyiv, you know, at this point, 4, 5, 6 weeks ago. And he was wrong about that. I think that's something that we can take heart in, that despite all of the internal threats we have, all of the real weaknesses we have, the deep way in which our society is divided, we can actually stand up for our values and we care about our values. And, you know, millions of people in Ukraine are risking their life in order to fight for a country in a way that I think is really impressive. So that's one link I would draw. The other link is that one of the things I defend in the new book is a form of patriotism. You know, I grew up as a German Jew, so patriotism and nationalism did not come naturally to me when I look at the history of a country in which I grew up.
Even more of just a normal German. It's already tough. Not that you're not a normal German as a Jew, but there's a double level there as well.
Yeah, so a lot of Germans are skeptical of patriotism because they look at their own history and say, oh, that's led us, you know, that's misled us. I sort of look at it and say, well, it hasn't turned out very well for my ancestors, right? And there are obviously forms of exclusionary nationalism that I'm deeply opposed to. But I think Ukraine also shows why patriotism can be a really important element in a diverse society. Now, Ukraine is diverse in very different ways from the way the United States is diverse, but it's sort of a split society linguistically, for example. And yet it is patriotism, it is love of a country, it is the determination to be able to decide your own fate that has made these millions of people go and fight against the Russian invasion. And I think that shows us the importance of patriotism. You know, it reminded me of something that I'd written about in the book, which is that George Orwell, one of my favorite writers, who risked his own life in the Spanish Civil War to fight on the side of the Republic against the fascists, and probably paid with it for his life, as probably the long-term impact on his health are one of the reasons why he died early. In the middle of World War II, wrote an essay in defense of patriotism, which seems really weird. But the reason is that he said, look, if British intellectuals had managed to succeed in teaching us not to be patriotic, we wouldn't have withstood the Blitz. The direct quote is, you know, VSS would now be patrolling the streets of London. And so he too recognized, even in the age of Hitler, that patriotism, rightly understood, is what you need in order to be able to fight for your values, in order to be able to defend liberal democracy.
And here's a question, and this is why the Ukraine war has jumbled a lot of the discourse from the past 4 years. Is there a difference between patriotism and nationalism? In the sense that nationalism during the Trump era specifically, that coded as this conservative or right-wing populist idea. But I think what you're seeing in Ukraine isn't merely just patriotism, but it's actually nationalism. I think in the best sense of the term, which is that there is something about the Ukrainian nation, which is unique, which is real, which is being defended against a Russian antagonism to that idea. Is there a distinction? Like, does that distinction matter? And can it be harnessed in a good way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, in philosophy, the distinction that's usually drawn between patriotism and nationalism is sort of patriotism is all the good things and nationalism is all the bad things, right? Yeah. And I'm tempted by that distinction. I get the point of that distinction because, you know, Putin claims to be a patriot and Ukrainians are patriotic. And I think that we should distinguish between them. There's a difference between a nationalism which says our country above everything else and I don't have to consider the legitimate claims of other nations. I have a right to rule over others, even if they don't want to be ruled by me. That is obviously a really bad thing. And then there's also positive forms of patriotism. There's forms of national sentiment which say we are able to have solidarity with each other, right? You and I, Marshall, we come from different ethnic groups, but we're both Americans, and we can feel a kinship through that. And that's actually a really positive thing. That might be a kind of constructive form of patriotism. Now, the problem with that distinction is that I think it's a little bit too clean. Mm-hmm. It sort of ignores the fact that the good sides and the bad sides are just two sides of the same coin. And that there's always a danger of one slitting into the other. And so I started to think of patriotism or nationalism as a half-domesticated beast, a half-domesticated animal, that the worst kinds of people could like incite, and then it's going to run wild and destroy everything. But we can also try and tame and make useful for us. And so then the question is, what's the notion of patriotism that you actually embrace? And so in my new book, in The Great Experiment, I say, and this is one chapter, there's all kinds of other things in the book, but on this, I say, look, there's three notions that have historically been influential. There's two notions that have historically been influential, one that I'm introducing in a way. So the first is an ethnic nationalism, right? That's saying what it is to be a Russian is to be descended from the same sorts of people. What is to be a real American is to be descended from the Mayflower or whatever, right? And that's obviously something that I reject, that I assume you would reject, because for a number of reasons, because it doesn't acknowledge the contributions of people who don't come from a dominant group. And most democracies in the world today are deeply diverse, give opportunities to people from all kinds of other ethnic groups to make a real contribution. And it's also empirically wrong, because actually that's not what most Americans think today. And in Western Europe, it's no longer what most people think anymore either. 50 or 60 years ago, you would have asked an average German, Italian, Greek, who's a real German and real Italian, real Greek? Well, is that somebody whose grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents also already came from here? Today, there's polls that show that's no longer the case, right? And of course, ethnic nationalism is dangerous because when you're saying, hey, there's something special about my ethnic group, that easily turns into, and therefore I get to dominate other ethnic groups, right? And so that obviously we should reject. Okay, so there's a second kind of way of thinking about patriotism, which is historically how people have done it, which is a civic or constitutional patriotism, right? What is it to love America? It's to love a constitution. It's to love a Bill of Rights. It's to love the Declaration of Independence. And that speaks to me in a deep way. I think it's an important element of patriotism. I became a U.S. citizen 5 years ago, and I was proud to swear to defend the Republic against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That's one of the things that appealed to me in becoming a citizen. But most people just don't care that much about politics, right? Most people, when you ask them, hey, do you like your country? How do you say, yeah, I love my country. Like, why? I don't know. They might tell you a million things. We're not going to save a constitution. We're not going to know what's in the Seventh Amendment, right?
Yes.
But that's why I think we should add a kind of third element to patriotism, which is a cultural patriotism. And when I say that, people always imagine sort of, I'm going to go on about the Mayflower and ancient costumes and Benjamin Franklin and all of that is, I mean, some obviously there's also dark aspects of American history, but, you know, the history of a country will always be part of its culture, and that's perfectly fine. But when I think of American culture today, it's way more down to earth and it's way more dynamic, right? I think most people, when they say they love a country, they love the city they grew up in, they love the landscapes in the country, they love the tastes and smells and sounds of their country. They love the kind of way we interact, you know, the way you and I interact is different from how we would interact if we were in Britain, and it's different from how French or German people interact. They love, you know, the celebrities, the TikTok stars, whatever, right? It doesn't have to be highfalutin. And that, I think, is a culture which people have a real attachment to, and which is in a very natural way diverse, which actually both integrates the contributions of people from all kinds of different groups and is felt among virtually everybody who's grown up in the United States. And so I think we should recognize that kind of cultural patriotism as an important element of what it means to love your country.
My reaction to what you're saying is that the way to square the circle of what I'm kind of getting at the start of the question is that there is such thing as wars of just national struggle. So, you know, you could think of Vietnam when it's right after World War II and the French are trying to establish the empire again in the country. Like that is a war of like national struggle. The war in Ukraine is a war of national struggle. And an aspect of that can be, there's obviously a deeply patriotic aspect to that. So I want to get to the diverse democracies part, but I want to pick at something you said a little earlier around Russia thinking the diversity of Western societies was a weakness. Russia, we'll put aside China for a second, but Russia is an incredibly diverse country. Sure. I think this would, for the folks who've been tracking the photos of dead Russian soldiers on Twitter, I think what would strike someone who didn't know that much about Russia would be struck at how many East Asian looking folks who do not look to be ethnically Western, Eastern European in look. So how do you think of diverse autocracies, diverse authoritarian states? How do you think about that dynamic?
Yeah, so this is, so let me respond in a slightly roundabout way, but it really is speaking to the question. So, I started to think about the fact that we're in a historically unprecedented situation, which is to have these deeply diverse societies, these deeply diverse democracies, which are trying to do something new, because the country where I grew up, Germany, at the founding of the successful West German democracy in 1948, was very homogeneous. And it became homogeneous as a result of genocide and expulsion and World War and so on. But it's not a surprise, I think, that the Federal Republic in 1948 worked and the Weimar Republic decades before had not worked, because the homogeneity made it easy. Right, and so they claim to be tolerant and inclusive and so on, but that's easy when 99% of your population sort of descends from the same ethnic group. Right, the United States obviously has been a very diverse country since the founding of the Republic, but it wasn't one that treated its various members equally. In fact, it horribly oppressed and excluded a number of groups, and particularly African Americans. And so what we're trying to do here is new as well, because for the first time we're trying to have a diversity and actually treat people as equals, right? Now, when I start to think, how do we make that work? What are the recipes? Can we succeed? Is it all doomed to fail? I first started to look at a whole bunch of diverse societies in the history of the world. And that's pretty sobering, because a lot of them went badly wrong. And even if they worked for a century or two, Often, eventually, they broke down into civil war and often even expulsions and genocide and really terrible stuff. So that's concerning, right? So then the second thought I had is, well, what about democracy, right? Can't democratic mechanisms save us here? Can they be the thing that actually help us out? But that's not so obvious either, because you look at the most famous democracies in history, and they prided themselves in the ethnic purity of either the state or at least the people who are full members of it, right? Ancient Athens, the Roman Republic, the city-states of medieval Italy, the people who actually were full citizens were ethnically, quote-unquote, pure. They were from one group. And then when you think, on the other hand, of some of the societies in the history of the world that are more diverse and where diversity worked relatively well for a while, a lot of them are not democracies. So, you know, Baghdad in the 9th century is a famous example, Vienna in the 19th century. Those were monarchies, those were empires.
So that's and like so for Vienna, that's like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, correct?
Exactly, yeah. And so, you know, we have all of these different national groups work, you know, live next to each other reasonably peacefully, but they don't get self-determination, and there's a monarch who tells them what to do. And that's actually not a coincidence, because, you know, if we're both living in a monarchy, then I can say, well, look, you know, if you have more kids or there's, you know, more people who are from your ethnic group immigrating, doesn't really affect me because I don't have any power. You don't have any power. As long as we both trust the monarch, it's sort of fine, right? In a democracy, you immediately get those demographic fears, which we're seeing so strongly in our politics today. It's like, hang on a second. If your group suddenly is becoming bigger than mine, then perhaps you're going to win re-election rather than me, because democracy is always searching for majorities, right? And so that becomes threatening in a completely different way. So there's at least one element of democracy which makes it harder to sustain diverse democracies. And so that's why, you know, in Yugoslavia and lots of other places, you've often had diverse societies held together by autocracy, but then explode once you try to make the transition to democracy. Now, Russia, in you know, it is a very diverse society. It's also a really racist one, and it's also one in which ethnic minorities are oppressed much worse than behind the United States in all kinds of ways. But yeah, it is often the case that democracy can make it harder, at least at first, for diverse societies to succeed.
Another thing that's coming out in your explanation is, could you articulate the difference between racial, ethnic identity and political identity? Because that's the part which is interesting to me, especially today, which is if you're looking at what is Elon Musk talking about when he says that Twitter, there's too much censorship. It's not, there's aspects of this. So there's a tinge of like, okay, Black Lives Matter versus like a MAGA person, border wall debates. But the deeper, more serious part of that debate is conservative, Republican, Democrat, liberal, progressive, whatever, pick whatever way you want to describe it. Help explain the difference in how that plays out in a democracy when this isn't just about pure ethnic groups, but it's also about actual ideas that could hypothetically exist in anyone's head, regardless of what they look like.
Yeah, that's a great question. So look, you know, when the founders were thinking about how to build a stable democracy, and you know, my book's title is The Great Experiment, and in a way, it's an allusion to the founders, because when the United States was founded, all of the attempts of building self-governing republics, democracies in recent history had gone badly wrong. There was barely any democracies or republics left at that moment, because so many of them had failed. So it was a really great experiment. They're saying, we can do what everybody else has failed to do. And how did they do that? Well, they said, look, all of these other republics failed because of factions. And those weren't by and large ethnic or religious factions. Sometimes that was the case. But precisely because so many democracies and republics until then had been pretty homogeneous, it usually wasn't ethnic or religious factions which led to civil war, like our civil war, right? That was in part of that. They were thinking, how do we deal with that? And so they were just dealing with the problem of political faction, the problem we have today, liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, et cetera, right? And they came up with this brilliant solution, which is that normally if we say, hey, there's a problem over there, how do we fix it? Well, let's reduce the problem, right? Let's reduce the size of a problem. And they sort of had the opposite solution. They said, it's not possible to reduce the number of factions or get rid of them without getting rid of liberty, and we're not willing to do that. So what are we going to do? We're going to have a really big state. We're going to give people a lot of freedom. And then actually we'll multiply the number of factions. And that'll be less of a problem because no single faction is going to think I'm able to win against everybody else. And so we'll all have to stick by the rules. So we'll say, well, look, since I'm not going to be able to dominate everybody else, we have to agree on a set of mutual rules, and that can keep the peace. What we didn't reckon with was the rise of political parties. And today we had this really complicated country with so many different groups, so many different geographic differences, economic differences, but somehow we still managed to assemble into two factions, Democrats and Republicans. And that's really dangerous for the stability of our political system. I think the founders would have been very worried about the rise of these two super factions, right? Okay, so that's one kind of division. Now, another kind of division, which also has often led to really terrible havoc in history. You can see that still today in Lebanon, you can see that in Afghanistan over the last decades, you can see that in so many parts of the world today, is, you know, the clash of different ethnic and religious groups, right? To say, hey, I am most deeply defined not by my political ideology, but by my kinship, by the group that I feel like I have an even deeper loyalty to. And I'm going to favor the members of this group, and I'm going to fight against the others. And that has often led to us being unable to build a state that works and is able to provide basic welfare benefits, build roads, and so on. It's led to civil war. It's led sometimes, when one group really wins and the others lose, to just terrible forms of domination, right? Now, what becomes particularly dangerous is when those two map onto each other, mm-hmm. right? When it's not just, hey, I'm a Democrat and I really want Democrats to win, and oh no, there's terrible Republicans just won. But if it's also, I'm a Democrat and I feel like Democrats speak for my ethnic group, mm-hmm. and now these terrible Republicans won, and that means that like those other groups that I'm afraid of or that I'm hostile to have also won, that becomes even more dangerous. And so in the American context, I really worry about this argument, which, you know, oddly everybody has started to believe over the last decades. You know, there's nothing today that conservatives and liberals, that Democrats and Republicans can agree on, other than this one really ambitious and wrong theory about the world. And that's that demography is destiny. That, you know, because white people are more likely to vote for Republican Party and various non-white groups are more likely to vote for Democrats, as the share of white people as a part of the US population decreases, you're gonna get you know, Democrats winning elections. And you can see that like a bunch of like the people who favor Donald Trump, like Michael Anton, influential conservative writer, really emphasized that when he made the case for why conservatives should vote for Trump. But you also see that in the strategy of Democrats, which is, you know, Latinos and Asian Americans and African Americans are always going to vote for us. We just have to get them to a polls and mobilize them. We don't have to persuade people, and then victory will be ours, right? And that, I think, is not only empirically wrong, thankfully, as we've seen in the 2020 election, for example, that Donald Trump was only competitive because he increased his share of the vote among every non-white voter group, and Joe Biden only became the 46th president because he had many more white voters than Hillary Clinton had 4 years ago. But it's also normatively wrong. It's a terrible idea for what our society is going to look like. If 20 or 30 years from now, I can walk down the street and know exactly who you vote for by the color of your skin, that's not going to be a good society. And by the way, you know, I prefer the Democratic Party at this point, so great, you know, Democrats are going to win in a way that's good. But if that means that there's like 47% of a population that's white, that by the way has a lot of guns, and that's really angry because they feel like our ethnic bloc is being outvoted at every election, that's not the recipe for a society in which anybody's going to be happy. So, you know, this idea of demography is destiny is really dangerous. Thankfully, it's wrong, but it does show the danger. It's a worst case scenario of when those political factions and those ethnic divisions map onto each other cleanly. That's a really dangerous place for society to end up in.
And to add another degree to which it's dangerous, it completely destroys the ability to set a proper immigration policy. So for example, you know, Tucker Carlson, you know, J.D. Vance has been on the show, like they will very openly speak of comprehensive immigration reform, DACA, Dreamers, all these different policies as, quote, Democrats bringing in more voters. And once again, like, I don't think that's literally happening. There isn't a person, I'm sure you know people who work in Congress, who work in the White House. There is not that level of like granular thinking when it comes to how you're going to actually win. But once again, it's viable for Tucker and JD to make that argument when you do have a lazy version of demography as destiny being basically used, right? And once again, like, you know, John Judas and Rui Teixeira have been very, you know, people misinterpreted their theory here, but their famous book was The Emerging Democratic Majority. And what happened is a bunch of folks who, as with Francis Fukuyama, didn't actually read the book, basically take the title and say, hey, like, you're going to have more minorities, you're going to have more upper middle class people, we're going to win. A lazy version of that can be interpreted by the other side in a very, very deleterious fashion.
And the lazy version of that is really influential in democratic politics, right? So Rui Teixeira, who to his real credit says, hey, you know, I mean, he says a little bit he was wrong and a lot, like, I was misinterpreted, and perhaps it's somewhere in the middle, you know? But he's going around saying, guys, this is like, you're going to keep losing if you think that my theory tells you you don't have to do anything and you're always going to win. And it's being completely ignored in democratic politics, right? So the bad version of this is really powerful. And you're absolutely right that it sort of breeds triumphalism among Democrats. There's some really interesting articles in 2016 by NPR, by Vox and so on, saying Hillary Clinton can't lose because if you do the demographic game and you break it down, it's just there's no way numerically that Trump can possibly win. Well, that clearly turned out to be wrong. And then exactly, it gives fodder to the people on the far right to say, well, these terrible people are coming in and we have no chance of winning them over. And so this is, you know, Michael Anton's essay that I mentioned talks about, I quote, the ceaseless importation of third world foreigners who don't care about the Republican Party and don't care about the Republic, right? Against Republican, smaller and Republican, larger R values, right? No, thankfully, that is wrong, right? As it turns out, the Republican Party is very competitive among Latinos when it tries, can be very competitive among other immigrants. That is a good thing. And I just wish that the Republican Party will go after the vote of non-white voters much more smartly and much more concertedly. And that the Democratic Party, instead of saying, we don't like the way that our politics is shaping up and we have ideas of abolishing the Senate or something, which is never going to happen, it's going to say, shit, we got to be able to compete in states where we used to win. We got to be able to compete in Ohio. How do we have a political program that is capable of doing that? That would be very healthy for American politics if both parties made those choices.
Reading the book and listening to you speak, my takeaway is just that one should be, not only is the idea wrong, but one, it prevents one from being humble about what you just cannot know in a messy democracy. So once again, the lazy version of demography as destiny is one that Republican, once again, I support comprehensive immigration reform. But in 2013, after President Obama won re-election, you had a whole set of Republican National Committee types say, okay, we now magically have to start supporting comprehensive immigration reform, not because we think it's the right idea necessarily, not because this is or that, but because we need to win Hispanic voters. And it turned out, whether you like Donald Trump or not, it actually turned out that Trump ran as a build the wall, very, you know, like insert the Taco Bowl incident during the primary, insert all these various statements he made. He still did better with Hispanic voters than Mitt Romney did, and then Republicans did in 2014. So it's this interesting point that it's not possible, as you said, to just basically pick and choose and talk. It's like this weirdly politically technocratic argument. You cannot just perfectly toggle the needle to like hit the right ethnic group percentage, because once again, that's what politics actually is or is not.
One thing that I'm just really struck by in this country is how much people stereotype what political ideas and values people have based on their ethnicity. And how much the more elite somebody is and the more education they have and the more likely they are to be, you know, some kind of strategist in the Democratic Party, the less they actually get what the genuine opinion of various demographic groups, especially but not only among non-white voter groups, is. So here's a really interesting fact. There was a poll a bunch of years ago about whether to build a wall on the southern border, which had a clear majority support. Do you know where this poll was taken?
Probably Texas.
Mexico.
Okay.
So a majority of Mexicans were in favor of building a wall on the southern border of Mexico, right? There's real cultural differences between Mexico and other Central American countries. And I'm not in favor of building a wall in the United States. I'm not in favor of building a wall on the southern border of Mexico either. But to assume that every Mexican American is going to be deeply offended by the idea of building a wall when a majority of people in Mexico are in favor of building a wall on the southern border of Mexico because they probably have a whole bunch of prejudices against El Salvadorians and Guatemalans and so on, just shows you how naive this view of what people tick is like. You have deep ethnic divisions in Central and Latin America, right? The people who think of themselves as white in those countries often have deep prejudices against people who they see as racially different, certainly among against native Latin Americans and so on. And the idea that all of this doesn't exist at all and that Latinos all sort of have the same political identity and that they all might not be reached by some of the arguments of Trump, much as I dislike them, is just a denial of what the world is like.
So something, here's what's interesting about the story you're telling around the dangers facing diverse societies. Like I'm sure you've noticed there's this real proliferation of, is the US going to go down the path to civil war, strife, conflict type things? In the societies you're describing, these Western societies that post-World War II, post-1965 in the case of the United States, post the end of their empires, have become much more diverse. The biggest actual conflicts, civil wars, tensions actually happened before the diversity actually entered into the space. So English Civil War, look at Germany, right? The 30 years war, like a third of the population dies. The US Civil War, like that is not a very diverse United States compared to today, obviously. So how should we think of the challenges facing diverse democracies when it comes to the topic of actual internecine conflict and violence in those different bits?
Well, look, different identities can be really salient in some contexts and not so salient in another context, right? In the United States, we think Catholics and Protestants, they have certain differences, but really, they're pretty similar, right?
They're Christians.
They're Christians. They get along, right? I mean, in Northern Ireland, you've had a conflict between Catholics and Protestants, a very violent conflict for a very long time now. I mean, for centuries of European history, the question of whether or not you should tolerate Protestant faiths was the reason for all kinds of war. And so, where conflict erupts really depends on political circumstances. There's a study that I found really fascinating that I talk about in the book in Southeastern Africa. Somebody went and looked at how Chewas and Tumbukas, two different tribes, think about each other. And when you go and speak to Chewas, and ask them in Malawi, and you ask them, how do you feel about Tumbukas? They have a pretty negative opinion. Like, oh, Tumbukas, they have weird customs. When a new couple gets married, they have to go live with a bride's family. That's really weird. They should live with a groom's family. And, they have these dances at their weddings, which are really odd. They're not, how you're supposed to dance at a wedding and so on, right? When they say, all right, well, would you ever marry a Tumbuka? Would you ever vote for a political candidate who's a Tumbuka? It's like, no. Most people said, never do that. Right? Then this researcher goes and talks to Tumbukas, and they have exactly the mirror image, right? It's like, well, Chewas are weird. They have the wrong dances. They should dance like us. They should go live with a groom's family, not the bride's family, right? And they too wouldn't vote for a Chewa. They wouldn't marry a Chewa, right? So you could say, hey, this is an ancient hatred, right? That's how journalists like to talk at the time of the Yugoslav Civil War, for example, right? Ancient hatred, these people have always hated each other, they're always going to hate each other, what can be done? Well, he went across the border to Zambia, and the border between Malawi and Zambia is one of those colonial borders drawn by some colonial officer in a kind of arbitrary way. So there's no important difference between those villages, which are really like a few miles apart from each other on different sides of the border. And he talks to Chewas and he says, are Tumbuka similar to you? No, there's these differences, we have different dances. It's like, well, how do you feel about them? Oh, pretty good. Oh, would you vote for a Tumbuka? Would you marry one? Sure, in principle, I wouldn't be opposed to marrying a Tumbuka. Yeah, I would vote for a Tumbuka. And same the other way around. So what's the difference? Why are they allies in Zambia and enemies in Malawi? The reason is politics, actually. Mm-hmm. So in Malawi, it's a pretty small country, and Chewas and Tumbukas are a very big share of it. And so they really compete for power, right? Each of these tribes is like, we might be able to win, and we have to mobilize against the other. Zambia is a much bigger country, and the tribes in eastern Zambia ally against the tribes in western Zambia. And so there, Chewas and Tumbukas work together because we have our differences, but at least we're more similar than those people over there in western Zambia, right? Mm-hmm. And so that explains the kind of difference. So all of which is to say, in a country like the United States, we're always going to have different groups, right, will always think of, you know, people will identify by different ethnic groups, different religions, and that's fine. But we also need to have a common identity. We also need to have something that gives us solidarity with each other. And what I'm worried about at the moment in our political discourse, in the way that education works in this country, in the message that a lot of really mainstream institutions are sending, is that it's telling people, you know, the most important thing about you is your subnational group, is your ethnic group, is your religious group. That is the thing that really matters. And, you know, that defines such a deep difference that you can't understand somebody who's a member of a different group. The only way you might be able to have solidarity is to say, we defer to you because you're more oppressed, not because we have shared political values. And then you get in the danger of really tearing a society apart. And that's one of the things I'm worried about at the moment.
And to go to your point earlier, when you were talking about how with the founders of the United States, there are going to be inevitable factionalism, the real tension in the identity group bit here is, on the one hand, there's the like obvious point that like, whoa, like this is all woke. It's like very arbitrary. And I think to certain degrees that can be true. But on the other hand, individualism is a deeply important part of Western, especially American society. So for me, my reaction is like, look, I may think it's weird that this person is like maybe Satan saying like Latinx or like doing this, this or that. But at the same time, that's their identity. They're an individual. They can decide that. So can you speak to the tension there? Maybe you don't see a tension, but I just see a tension between.
I think there's a way of resolving that in a principled way. I have a whole chapter that puzzles through this, but that's a basic question, right? We have a state. We have to have some kind of national identity to sustain the welfare state and build roads and have an army and all that stuff. We have groups, right? People strongly feel, it's important to me that I come from this cultural group or from this ethnic group, that I have a religion that obviously I feel really strongly I need to worship in this particular kind of way. But then you also have individuals, right? You also want to feel like, hey, I get to decide myself how to live, and perhaps I disagree with my parents about what kind of things I should do in life, right? So how do we deal with the relationship between these different kinds of levels? Now, the way I think about this is that you want to give people two freedoms at the same time. The first freedom is that we have to be saved from the tyranny of the state and of the majority, right? But you have to say, hey, I can be an ethnic minority and I'm not scared of being treated badly by the cops, of being treated badly by people in society. I can have a religion which perhaps is unpopular, right? I can be a Muslim or I can be a Jehovah's Witness. And, you know, even for a lot of people in society might disapprove of my religion for some reason, I'm going to be able to go and worship and I'm not going to be at risk, right? So that's the classic kind of freedoms we have to give people. But then we also have to give you a second freedom, which is, there's a great book by Dan Acemoglu and James Robinson called The Narrow Corridor, where they talk about this. Most people in the history of the world actually haven't been oppressed by the state or by an outside majority. They've been oppressed by their own group. They've been enclosed in a cage of norms, where your own parents, your own siblings, your own village, your own community, your own priest or imam or rabbi tells you, this is what you do and you better do that, otherwise we're going to punish you in some kind of way. And so the second freedom you've got to have is if you're gay in a deeply evangelical family, the state stops you from being, exorcised, from being sent to conversion therapy or something like that, right? If you're a family where the parents are saying, hey, if you don't marry somebody from our own religious group, or if you have a boyfriend before you're married, we're going to beat you up, or perhaps we're going to threaten to murder you. The state has to intervene and make sure that you get to make your own decisions. And so, you know, one way of thinking about this is sort of multiculturalist or communitarian. So these people say we're just an association of associations. Different groups are the building blocks of our society. That, I think, is wrong because it can't explain why the state has a right to intervene when a group oppresses its own members. And it then raises the risk, but we just end up falling apart. But there's a second notion, which is philosophically liberal, which says, hey, you have rights and duties as an individual. And we recognize how important groups are going to be to many people. That's why the freedom of worship, the freedom of association are the classic liberal rights. So we're going to respect the groups you are part of. We're going to realize that a lot of the time you didn't choose them. like from scratch. You're like going to stay a member of the groups you're born into and that your parents are part of most of the time. But the reason why we respect those groups is that you have a freedom to leave, right? The dignity of the groups comes from the fact that the people who are in them want to be in them, that they have a right to choose to leave at any point. And that's what makes them valuable. That's what ensures that they're not oppressive.
So for the last section here, I want to hit the top line and throw everyone to the book to learn more. But I love the way you set up that 1776, 87, 89, 90, the US embarks upon an experiment with, can you actually build a democracy that functions separate from the diversity question? That was the experiment going on, 200 plus years that is working. What is the experiment that we have undergone in these diverse democracies today then?
Yeah, so I think the great experiment what we're doing today is that, in 1776, all men are created equal. Well, unfortunately, that was not the reality of the United States. And I think now in a much more serious way, we are trying to treat all American citizens as equals. Legally, we do that. In practice, we often don't. And so I think that is really a new point of departure, right? How do you have these societies which every society feels like it's diverse, right? Catholics versus Protestants, we're really different to each other. And in some societies, that can be really powerful. But we've leveled up, right? Mm-hmm. We have many more religions, people who are, visually in a salient way, more different from each other. It's just harder when you have a society that's as diverse as the United States is today. And so that's something new. We don't have a recipe. We don't have a precedent. And so what I do in the book is, first of all, to say, this is really hard. We like to say, oh, diversity is our strength. And, how hard is it not to hate your neighbor? How hard is it to be tolerant, be a decent human being? But when you look at the basic mechanisms of human psychology, of favoring the in-group over the out-group, when you look at all the examples of societies in history that have gone wrong, you realize that it is hard. And so that's scary, because if it goes wrong, it could go really, really badly wrong. And we can't exclude that possibility. But ironically, I actually draw a lot of optimism from the fact that it's hard, because when you judge our current reality by that standard, you can also see that we've made real progress, that despite the deep injustices we have today in America, actually we're doing way better than most societies around the world, and we're doing way better than we ourselves were 50 or 25 years ago. Let me tell you one example that I think is interesting. On the far right, there's a pessimism which says, look, the success of American society historically has been its majority ethnic group and its majority religious group. And so now that whites are supposedly going to be in the minority, all that's going to go to shit, right? Because you have all of these people who are somehow inferior culturally or perhaps even racially, supposedly, coming in, and they're just not as good, and they're not integrating, and they're not making socioeconomic progress, and everyone's terrible, right? Now, I reject it. Most people I know reject that. But in an odd way, people who I know, a lot of the mainstream discourse, has a version of that claim. They don't blame immigrants or minority groups, but they say our society is so discriminatory, is so racist, is so unjust. And there's obviously deep injustices, but it's so unjust that immigrants can't succeed to integrate. And African-Americans are never going to go get ahead, right? And when I actually started to look at the figures in quite a lot of detail, I realized that this pessimism of my own friends was actually ill-founded. But for example, when you look at immigrants today from El Salvador and Mexico and Vietnam and Zimbabwe and all kinds of other places, they are making socioeconomic progress, educational progress, they are integrating in terms of language and other cultural traits about as quickly as Italian and Irish immigrants did a century ago. Mm-hmm. Now,
so the process hasn't slowed down in terms of like that part.
No, so that's the best study on this with a million data points says it's the same speed. It takes a while. It's not an easy process, but it's the same speed as with Italian and Irish immigrants a century ago. Now, what does that show us? What shows us, number one, that those kind of ethno-nationalists on the far right are wrong. There's not anything inferior about El Salvadorians or Vietnamese people coming in today compared to Italians and Irish people a century ago. But it also, by the way, shows that the people are so pessimistic about our society from the left, where they say, Italians and Irish could integrate because they're white, but we're not giving the same opportunities to today's immigrants who are mostly non-white because we're so racist, that's also wrong. Yes, there is racism. Yes, there is discrimination. But actually, these immigrants are succeeding to integrate. And that also says something good about our society.
So we gave the example of the Roman and Austro-Hungarian empires as diverse societies that weren't democracies, but like did not largely function. As we're nearing the end here, what country should folks think of as the nightmare scenario for the dynamics we're talking about? I'm wearing, YouTube people will see this, I'm wearing like a South African rugby. So I've obviously have a bit of a bias on this question, but I think South Africa is an example of a society that initially showed a lot of promise post-apartheid, but obviously very clearly there's been a deep regression when it comes to the optimism pessimism balance. So I'm just curious. So that's my own personal take. And that's, once again, this isn't to say South Africa is going to fall apart, but the story that you tell, I grew up in the 1990s, obviously. So the story that people tell about South Africa now is very different than the one that I grew up with personally. How would you articulate like your version of this?
Yeah. So I guess I would say, so in my book, I say there's three modes of failure, which tend to recur. So one is domination, right? One is just one group manages to win power and just treats all the other groups terribly. So that's the United States in the past, right? I mean, one nightmare scenario is the United States in 1830. Some great things about America in 1830, one really, really, really terrible things that makes it all unsustainable, right? And that you see in many, as a danger in many societies in the world today. I think there's a danger in India that Hindus are going to become not just the biggest group, but the group that really dominates other religious groups and discriminates against them in a deep way. You can see the danger in all kinds of different societies. So domination, one danger. The second danger is anarchy, or what I call structured anarchy. So that's that different groups are so scared of each other, so rival to each other, that they can't cooperate in a meaningful way. And the obvious example of that is Afghanistan, right? For many centuries, there are so many different clans and so many different groups that they thought, if we actually build a state together, you might be in power, and then you might use all the machinery of the state to oppress me, domination. So to avoid that, we're not going to build a state. But then you have no roads, no hospitals, bad public education, really terrible outcomes, low life expectancy, you know. I mean, the third danger, which is perhaps the most relevant in some ways in the United States, is about a fragmentation. And that's the example of Lebanon, right? In Lebanon, most people don't feel Lebanese. They feel Shia or Sunni or Maronite Christian. I mean, institutions don't give Lebanese citizens rights. They give groups rights. And who you can marry and what kind of laws you're subject to, what kind of education you receive, is then become subject to your own group. And so, you know, just to close perhaps on a more positive note, a sort of a lost strand earlier in the conversation about, you know, how should we think about groups in America? I think groups have great value. One of the things I love about America is how visible different groups are, you know, from the stupid level of culinary stuff, right? Great for food, to a deeper way, right? I think it's great that people in this country can have these different communities which they have deep meaning to, which give them meaning, which structure their life in many cases, and that's great. But that's going to come naturally. Mm-hmm. What's hard is also to sustain a national sense of togetherness. What's hard is also to say, hey, this person who looks different from me, who lives in a different part of a country, has different religious beliefs, they're also somebody who I should care for. And so when I look at something like education, you know, kids in high school, 15, 16, choosing cultural clubs based on their ethnic group or their cultural interest, that's perfectly fine. They're doing it themselves. That's part of freedom of association. I don't worry about that. Elite private schools in a lot of the country, you know, sit with friends in DC where presidents tend to send their kids, you know, Dalton and Horace Mann in New York City. Now taking kids at the age of 10, 8, sometimes 6, and the teacher comes in and says, hey, you're black, you go to a black group over there. You're Asian, whatever that means. You go to the Asian American group over there. You're Latino, you go to the Latino group over there. And then you're white, so I guess you go to the white group. That is really dangerous, because I think that is giving an authoritative message that the most important thing about you is your racial identity. And then, by the way, you have a problem with white kids, because do you have them do nothing? Or I guess you like try and get them to be like convinced anti-racist activists or something, and that might work for a few of them, but But everything I've learned from human psychology is that if you tell somebody, this is your most important characteristic, you tend to fight for that group rather than against that group. And there's actually some great evidence of that, that when you give people a lecture on white privilege, they actually perform sort of in a more racially discriminatory manner on the implicit association test. So those kind of tendencies in our society, I worry about, because I think they can push us towards fragmentation in a way that will make it harder for us to build diverse democracies that actually succeed.
Yasha, this has been really great. I'd love for you just to shout out the book. It's out today. Full title, Helps Move, everything, yeah.
Of course. So the book is The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Societies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure. And if you love good podcasts, then come listen to my podcast, The Good Fight, as part of Persuasion as well.
Great. Yasha, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Marshall.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.